Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast will cover key data presented at the EHA 2021 Virtual Congress on new and emerging treatments for the improvement of outcomes in high-risk MDS and newly diagnosed AML patients. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Novartis. Yeah, hello everybody. My name is Uwe Platzbeck. I'm professor of hematology and head of the Clinic of Hematology, Cell Therapy and Hemostasiology at the University Hospital Leipzig in Germany. And today I will be sharing my interpretation of data from the last EHA meeting, EHA 2021, on improving outcomes in high-risk MDS and newly diagnosed AML, and also what that may mean to your clinical practice. So the overview which I will give is actually on data which are aligning with the improvement of outcomes in high-risk MDS and newly diagnosed AML patients. This may include mode of action and key clinical data for emerging treatments for high-risk MDS patients. On top, also current treatments and novel approaches for newly diagnosed AML, including management options when intensive induction therapy is not suitable. And I will also highlight current and future potential of immunotherapeutic agents and the use of MRD monitoring in MDS and AML. So I will basically start with emerging treatments for higher risk MDS. And if we talk about higher risk MDS, this is a, I think, still very heterogeneous group of patients. And these patients, most of them have excessive blasts, and they have also bad risk, poor risk cytogenetics, and a high propensity to undergo AML evolution. So therefore, the treatment goal for these patients is to delay disease progression and prolong survival. And apart from the potentially curative allogeneic stem cell transplantation option, which is actually eligible only to a minority of patients, there is an unmet medical need still, because azacitidine, so HMA-based treatment, is actually the only potential treatment option apart from standard intensive chemotherapy. We know that azacitidine or also decitabine, at least, is approved in the United States and in the European Union for first-line treatment. And the reason why this actually happened is because in the pivotal study with azacitidine, azacitidine improved basically survival compared to standard of care in these patients. So novel agents are currently entering the stage in combination with azacitidine, and some of them I will also highlight in my presentation, like venetoclax, pevonedistat, and IDH1 and 2 inhibitors. So let's start with the first presentation from the EHA performed by Mikhail Sekeres, pevonedistat, and azacitidine. It's actually a combination which has been explored in a large phase two program, and the data have been published with regards to the response rate. The response rates were much higher in the AZA pevonedistat arm compared to the azacitidine arm. So the study now, which was presented at the EHA meeting, looked for the pre-specified comparative analysis of mutant allele burden in each study arm over time via an ultra-sensitive sequencing strategy. So just looking for the expansion of treatment-emerging mutations between the arms. And not unexpectedly, there was a significant difference between both study arms. The expansion of so-called treatment-emergent mutations was 49.6% in the AZA arm, and was 29.3% 3% in the azapevonetistat arm, which basically demonstrate a significantly less expansion of treatment emergent mutations in the combination arm, which also is in line with the notion that the combination is more effective, not only on a CR level, but also on an MRD level, which I think is striking and an important information. And what also came out from this study that pavo-azacitidine combination also reduces the mutational burden, of course, compared with AZA alone, which may also result in a lowering of the likelihood of treatment emergent resistance and also may increase the durability of treatment response. Because what we know now with these agents, this combination of HMA plus in the first line setting, that many of these combinations induce a higher rate of complete remission and also very early. But the major issue for our patients is that the durability and to maintain this remission. So these molecular data actually point into this direction that azacitidine, of course, is less effective with regards to the also expansion of treatment emergent clones. The next agent I'm going to introduce is actually sabatolimab, which is a TIM-3 inhibitor. The TIM-3 is a checkpoint not only expressed on T cells, but also on leukemia progenitor cells. So it's a dual mechanism how sabatolimab may work. And the study I'm highlighting here is a study looking for the combination treatment in patients with newly diagnosed high-risk MDS, but also AML patients not eligible for intensive chemotherapy, the so-called stimulus program, which was actually run in 8 countries and 11 trial centers in patients with the median age of 70 years. The study looked now for the efficacy in the very high-risk and high-risk MDS patients according to the IPSSR. And on top of a 20% CR rate, which is what you would expect from azacitidine alone, the investigators observed a 10% marrow CR with hematologic improvement, and on top a 24% of marrow CR. So with an overall response rate, including stable disease and AHI and PR of 58%, which is significantly higher compared to historical controls with azacitidine alone. And also what was really interesting was that the tolerability of sabatolimab was pretty impressive. So it did not add any significant toxicity to the azacitidine backbone. The next option is venetoclax plus AZA for treatment naive higher risk MDS patients. Again, the rationale is the same. And venetoclax, as we know, has been already approved for elderly AML first line treatment. So this this study here, it's actually from a phase 1, phase 2 program, looked for the CR rate, but also survival, duration of response, and it basically showed an 80% response rate, combined CR, marrow CR, and PR. Survival rate was 28 months. Again, from the pivotal studies with azacitidine, we know the median survival in high-risk MDS is between 18 to 22 months, so significantly longer. Also duration of response, 13.8 months. So again, confirming the rapid and also durable response with azacitidine plus venetoclax. The study also looked for side effects, and the side effects were actually what you would expect from this combination, also with the knowledge now we have from AZA-VEN in elderly AML patients. So febrile neutropenia occurred in a substantial amount of patients, and also 36% of the patients required at least one ven dose reduction, mainly due to toxicity or starting a CYP3A inhibitor concomitant treatment. Febrile neutropenia occurred actually in 45% of the patients, but still the majority of these toxicities were very well manageable, and also sometimes patients required hospitalization. So the next study is about enasidenib in high-risk IDH2 mutated MDS patients. It's a study which actually evaluated the safety and tolerability of enasidenib plus minus azacitidine in patients being either HMA naive, 26 patients actually were studied, or refractory progressive MDS to prior HMA therapy, where enasidenib was studied alone. And this was done in 22 patients. So the overall response rate for the combination was actually striking with 84%. And this comprised 24% CR, 8% PR, and 44% marrow CR. And for the single agent in AZA failure patients, the overall response rate was 43% with enasidenib only. Again, 24% of these patients achieved a CR, which is quite impressive. So the overall survival for the combination treatment in the first line setting was 32 months. And for the enasidenib single agent, it was 21 months. So again, I think much longer compared to what you would expect for azacitidine alone or, for instance, with best supportive care in the HMA failure. What about side effects? Most common AE of all grades in both study arms were nausea and constipation, 60% versus 44% in the enasidenib plus azacitidine arm, and 29 and 10% in the enasidenib only arm, respectively. Mostly mild and well manageable. Differentiation syndrome was also developed in a minor subgroup of patients, however, also pretty well manageable and not life threatening. So the bottom line message here is combination, but also single agent, is very well tolerated in IDH2 mutated MDS patients and comes along with a promising efficacy. So to summarize, I think we have a lot of evidence that novel agents combined with azacitidine are not only, I would say, rather well tolerable, but also very efficacious for the treatment of higher risk MDS patients, either in the first line setting or in the second line setting. I think the majority of these agents have already entered or will enter a phase 3 program. So the jury is still out whether this will be positive and we will have new agents in the future. But I think it expands the therapeutic opportunities significantly to our patients. So we now switch gears and go into the AML segment. I think AML is, of course, like high-risk MDS, a disease with an unmet medical need. However, we have now a lot of agents approved in the last couple of years. Still, HMA-based treatment plus venetoclax is, I think, the standard of care for elderly AML patients not eligible for intensive chemo, while the younger undergo intensive chemo plus minus agents like Mylotarg or midostaurin in case of FLT3 ITD mutation, and then undergo stem cell transplantation based on their mutational or genetic profile. IDH, IDH2 mutations are present in up to 15% of the patients. We have two inhibitors, but they are actually not approved in the European Union, but in the United States so far. FLT3 mutations, as I said before, can be targeted in the first-line setting with midostaurin, and in the relapse setting, gilteritinib is an approved therapeutic options. So this, I think, is the backbone to know for what has been then presented at the EHA. And the first presentation is about real-world data for AZA or decitabine plus venetoclax in newly diagnosed or relapsed refractory AML patients. And these real-life experiences are important because we have the VIALE-A study, which led to the approval of this combination. And the study I'm presenting here actually investigated this in a retrospective manner, and they basically saw a 54% response rate, including 23% CR in newly diagnosed AML patients and 26% overall response rate in relapse refractory patients, median survival 10 versus 6.7 months respectively. So although the patient numbers were rather limited, I think the data, also including the toxicity data, mainly neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, showed the manageable toxicity profile and also the meaningful efficacy, mimicking also the phase 3 program. Another study actually investigated a quite interesting concept of combining azacitidine with a LSD1 inhibitor, which is actually a first-in-class treatment option for elderly unfit patients. The name is Ladademstat. It's a phase 2A study for elderly patients above the age of 60 years, unfit for intensive chemotherapy. And quite striking response rates, overall response rate, CR, CRI, overall response rate is 83% with a CR-CRI rate of 67%. The adverse events mainly included neutrophil decrease, so heme toxicity, but also other toxicities like dysgeusia, anemia, asthenia, constipation in more than 10% of the patients. But the authors concluded with a limited number of patients that the combination was had a manageable safety profile with, and I do agree with that, with a very promising efficacy data. So to summarize, I think the real world data support the use of venetoclax HMA in patients with AML not eligible for high intensive chemotherapy regimen. The first in class LSD1 inhibitor plus azacitidine, I think, produced promising efficacy data, but not at the expense of toxicities. I think the data so far look very promising. So next step is to talk about current and future potential of immunotherapy and the use of MRD monitoring. And I think if we talk about MRD and immunotherapy, I think immunotherapy is, of course, very strong now in solid cancers, but I think apart from allotransplant, it is, at least for AML and MDS, is not a valid option in the majority of the patients. However, MRD, I think, has become a very useful outcome measure, especially for patients in complete remission, where you can have a trackable mutation and may predict the outcome. For instance, NPM1 mutations presenting in actually 30% of AML patients are a key example of a targeted MRD monitoring, which of course may also result in preemptive strategies in case of rise of MRD, for instance, by novel techniques like next generation sequencing. So currently, flow cytometry and quantitative PCR are the preferred methods for monitoring. However, clinical trials are ongoing also to use exactly the utility of next generation sequencing, especially in patients undergoing allogeneic stem cell transplantation. So this is actually the first study looked for MRD response with AZA venetoclax in the VIALE-A study. And the bottom line message is that also in this study, MRD was an important predictor of outcomes of patients being MRD positive or MRD negative at the time of entry into the study had a significantly different outcome with regards to duration of response, overall survival, and event-free survival. You know, this is a study where, of course, patients were given HMA plus venetoclax as a first-line treatment, and patient achieving an MRD negativity had a duration of response of 82.2 months versus 46.6 months being MRD positive. This was actually also the true for overall survival, 94% versus 67%, and event-free survival. So MRD is a surrogate marker for the depth of a response, also with an HMA plus venetoclax first-line treatment. MRD less than 10 minus the 3 response was actually associated with a longer durability of response, event-free survival, overall survival, patients therefore now undergoing Aza-Ven first-line treatment also in the routine setting, I think, should be checked for MRD, and also MRD positivity may be a kind of red light for preemptive or earlier interventions before the disease actually is progressing. So next study was about NGS-based MRD monitoring in FLT3 ITD AML-treated patients with midostaurin. So this was taken from a prospective phase 2 study combining intensive chemotherapy plus midostaurin in FLT3 mutated patients. You know, FLT3 ITD occurs in roughly 25% of the patients, and it is now midostaurin is now approved for the concomitant administration. And therefore, what about MRD as an integral part of the assessing the response in patient achieving a complete hematological remission? This was actually done by an NGS-based method in order to identify patients who are at high risk of subsequent relapse. The study basically showed that patients with a decrease of the allelic burden of the FLT3 ITD and also maybe achieving an MRD negativity had a much better prognosis than comparing to patients not achieving this. So therefore, the bottom line message here was that NGS-based MRD monitoring is a promising tool for assessing the response to therapy and also to identify patients with a high risk of treatment failure, irrespective of the combined treatment. So the bottom line message from these presentations was that MRD is important not only in the context of intensive therapies, but also in the context of azacitidine venetoclax-based treatment for elderly AML patients. So thank you very much for watching this summary of emerging treatments for MDS and AML from the EHA 2021 Virtual Congress. I hope it has been useful for you and you enjoyed the presentation.
Thank you, Professor Platzbecker. Let's involve your colleagues now also so they can share their thoughts and interpretation of the data presented at EHA 2021 Virtual. Professor Wei, based on the data presented at EHA 2021 Virtual, what do you consider to be the most promising novel treatments for patients with higher risk MDS?
There were a number of abstracts and oral presentations presented at EHA, and these focus on new drugs targeting, for instance, BCL2, such as venetoclax, TIM3, such as sabatolimab, NET8, such as pevonedistat, and previously at other congresses, very important targeting of CD47 with magrolimab. With venetoclax, the excitement around this combination with azacitidine is that in patients with high-risk MDS, it can produce very high response rates on the order of 80%, and this is certainly a much higher rate than the historical levels of response we've seen with azacitidine. With respect to sabatolimab, this combination, again, with hypomethylating agents produced quite interesting response rates. And also presented at this meeting was that these responses tend to be preserved in patients with higher risk disease, such as patients with P53 mutation and other poor risk mutations. With respect to pevonedistat, this was a paper presented by Mikhail Sekeris, combining pevonedistat with azacitidine. This work has recently been published in Leukemia, and the overall response rate on an intention to treat basis was 47%, with a high proportion of complete remissions. And finally, at a previous congress, it's important to know that azacitidine in combination with magrolimab is also another combination which is currently in pivotal stages of clinical development. And so many of these drugs could make it to hopefully approval in the future. None of them have reached that stage as yet, and we await with great interest the results from future congresses.
Professor Sanchini, which novel treatments do you consider most promising for high-risk MDS?
It is an interesting question and a challenge. There were more than a couple of new agents presented and the results of the new agents, the most interesting one being pevonedistat, sabatolimab, and of course, venetoclax, that is a therapy that is used more and more even in MDS. Now, pevonedistat is really an effective drug with an overall response rate in higher risk MDS that is nearly 80% with 50% of CR. So very effective. Now, what has been very interesting at EHA is that the data regarding the disease-modifying activity of pevonedistat has been addressed. In fact, pevonedistat is decreasing the clonal expansion in patients receiving azacitidine and pevonedistat. That means that nearly 30% of the patient did still have an increase in the number and the variant allele frequency of the somatic mutation, but compared to azacitidine alone, this was a significantly less percentage, meaning that the drug is acting on the dysplastic clone and prevents a clonal expansion. And this is true also if you do not achieve CR, but only hematological improvement. So pevonedistat has a mechanism of action that is well-defined, is a NED8 inhibitor, NEDylation inhibitor, and you know that is given IV without substantial adverse event beyond the ones showed by azacitidine. And in terms of tolerability, another agent that is sabatolimab with a complete different mechanism of action has been updated at EHA by Andrew Wei. And the data are also quite interesting. Now, sabatolimab is an anti-TIM3 antibody. Is therefore an immune checkpoint modulator, but it's actually more than an immune checkpoint inhibitor, has a dual efficacy in terms of immune and myeloid modulation, because TIM3 is expressed both on macrophages and immune cells and leukemic and dysplastic cells. Therefore, the antibody is acting very effectively. And the data presented here are related to the combination of sabatolimab, azacitidine, and decitabine. It's a phase one to assess the right dose that was given once or twice a month, and 400 and 800 milligrams. And actually, in high-risk MDS, the overall response rate was 58%, with a very high CR rate, 44%. So if you keep in mind what was obtained with azacitidine alone, this is almost the double. What is more interesting here at EHA has been the fact that the authors have compared the results obtained in patients with specific somatic mutation. And what was quite important is that TP53 mutated patients would respond in a high percentage of cases, because it was more than 70% overall response rate. And what is really quite important as well is the fact that the duration of response is around 16 months. And even for other prognostic negative somatic mutation, the duration of response is longer than 1 year. So I think that only the cytogenetic very poor risk patients will not have such a long duration of response. So again, complete different mechanism of action, very good response. And then in addition, we have the data of venetoclax and azacitidine that are also very interesting. You know that venetoclax is approved for the therapy of AML, not for a high-risk MDS. But there are now several evidence, and we can discuss them later as well. Here, the data presented were related to patients with elderly patients as well, like in the previous studies, 70-year median age. And the actual results were pretty interesting because the patients who received venetoclax and azacitidine had a very long duration of response, more than 1 year. And the overall survival was above 2 years. What, again, here as well has been presented is the result of the patients who had TP53 mutation or other prognostic negative somatic mutation. So patients with TP53 mutation had an overall response rate that was above 80% and a CR rate that was 16%, so a little bit less. But what is really important is that this kind of approach has been considered for frail, high-risk MDS patients quite toxic. So what I want to stress is that in this data presented at EHA, the venetoclax dose was 400 milligrams, but was given for 14 days and not for 28 days like the schedule we have for AML. So it was pretty well tolerated, although myelosuppression was the first and most important side effect. So what I really think here is that we have quite a number of drugs that can be used and have a very good efficacy in high-risk MDS. There are more coming, so I think that next months will be very interesting for the development of new therapies and combination therapies.
What's your take on the most promising new therapies, Professor Platzbecker?
I think at the moment, plenty of studies and initiatives are ongoing in high-risk MDS. The backbone of all of these studies, of course, is azacitidine as our single-agent standard of care for high-risk MDS patients. And these studies combine novel agents with azacitidine, and I would like to highlight a couple of these agents. I think number one is pevonedistat, an adenylation inhibitor, which is already in a phase 3 program. The readout of this study may occur pretty soon. The other agent is venetoclax, which just had entered a phase 3 program for elderly MDS patients, higher-risk MDS patients, again, in a parallel initiative compared to elderly AML patients. So we expect same toxicities there. And I think the data we have seen also at the EHA basically point into this direction. Other agents which have not been extensively discussed in the setting of MDS at the EHA are actually magrolimab, also very interesting combination partner for azacitidine, and of course, the IDH inhibitors, which I think are also an interesting combination partners for an HMA-based treatment.
Coming back to you, Professor Santini, are there any specific mutations targeted by any of the emerging treatments for higher risk MDS? And if so, is this likely to change current routine patient genetic analysis?
The abstract presented at EHA regarding therapy of high-risk MDS all included the molecular evaluation of somatic mutation. Just to point out that the agents were active more or less in the specific subgroup and with the specific mutation. And there was one presentation regarding the use of inazidinib that is not approved, again, in high-risk MDS, but in AML. And the data were even better than the ones we saw published in Lancet, because the CR rate for inazidinib in relapsed patient having received HMA was extremely good, because it was 43% overall response rate. And the addition of inazidinib to azacitidine was also increasing the response. So given these results, we may say that we would like to know for all our patients, even the frailer ones that can receive a therapy, we would like to know the molecular pattern and the presence of somatic mutation. And as I alluded to previously, knowing the variant allele frequency of the mutation is also quite important to realize how therapies are working and how they are obtaining a good response in terms of disease modification. So I think that the approach would be to the general management of MDS patients will be including the molecular studies and the NGS evaluation of somatic mutation. It's important for all the reasons I said. Now, in specific, enasidenib, you know that is very active now. We know that in high-risk MDS may be really specifically active in IDH2 mutated ones. Of course, it's a very small subgroup of patients, but if this group of patients can take advantage of this target therapy, I think that we have to know it. And I would add a very important note. I am checking baseline patients at diagnosis for baseline somatic mutation, but at relapse after HMA or any therapy they receive, I do re-evaluate the presence of somatic mutation. So they may, in fact, appear new mutation, and you can target them even in the relapse setting. So IDH2, again, is 5-10% of MDS patients, but still needs to be evaluated.
Do you have anything to add on targeting mutated high-risk MDS, Professor Platzbecker?
I think at the moment, the data emerge and basically show that with the novel combinations, you may be able to eradicate or to basically induce a decline of the mutational burden more rapidly, but also more sustainable with the combination treatments compared to HMA or azacitidine alone. And also this explains why the duration of response and also the depth of response is better with these new agents. On the other side, the prognostic impact of certain mutations is obviously not overridden by these combination treatments. For instance, we know for azacitidine plus venetoclax that P53 mutations are still a marker for a worse outcome, even in the combination treatment compared to other mutations and to another mutational profile. So I think mutations are still very important in the workup for these patients. They may also be used as an MRD assessment and MRD option. But I think on the final run, we will definitely go for maybe more druggable targets and for with agents who may be able, for instance, to specifically target mutations like P53 or others. Other options, of course, are IDH inhibitors, which also have shown interesting efficacy and also durability of response with the combination of HMA. So this may be also an interesting target for combination treatments, including azacitidine, for instance, with venetoclax as a backbone. So I think the future is bright, and we will learn with these studies a lot, and also this will change our algorithm in the clinic.
Professor Wei, what are your thoughts?
At this stage, we use molecular genetics in several ways. So first of all, in patients with higher risk MDS, according to the revised IPSS score, there was a very important paper presented a number of years ago by Raphael Bejar, published in Blood 2014, where patients with either very low, or intermediate risk disease with respect to MDS by the IPSS score could be upscaled if there was the presence of either a TP53 mutation or other mutations such as ETV6, ASXL1, EZH2, or RUNX1. And so genetics can certainly help prognosticate patients with lower risk MDS into a higher risk category. With respect to new treatments, Currently, there is no pivotal study demonstrating that practice has been changed with respect to a molecular abnormality and targeting by a new drug. However, there are certainly some very intriguing possibilities. So first of all, for patients with IDH2 mutant MDS, there was a nice paper presented at EHA 21 by Sangeetha Varengapal from MD Anderson, who presented some data with the IDH2 inhibitor enasidenib in combination with hypomethylating agents, showing that there was a combined response rate of 84% for patients with higher risk MDS. There was also another interesting paper presented by Guillermo Garcia Manero, again from MD Anderson, of a new drug called CA4948, which targets a protein called IRAK4, I-R-A-K. And there is an interesting correlation in the data presented by Dr. Manero that patients with a spliceosome mutation might be potentially sensitive to this particular drug. Of the five responses that were recorded in this phase one study, three in fact had a spliceosome mutation. Furthermore, for some of the drugs that I've presented before, particularly venetoclax in combination with azacitidine, and hypomethylating agents in combination with sabatolimab, both of these drugs appear to have quite interesting and high responses in patients with P53 mutation, which currently have a very poor prognosis. So hopefully genetics in the future can help with prognosis, identifying patients with actionable targets such as IDH mutations, and also the potential to identify drugs which might have greater activity than historical agents for poor-risk subgroups.
Back to you, Professor Platzbecker. Considering AML now, how is the treatment landscape evolving for patients with newly diagnosed AML? Do you think targeted therapies are likely to replace intensive chemotherapy regimens for AML in the near future?
I think that we have to differentiate between elderly patients and, let's say, younger patients. In elderly, I think intensive chemo has never been an option, but let's say the HMA-based treatment was the standard of care as a single agent for a long time. Now I think we build on doublets and maybe in the future also triplets, which will definitely not allow any patient to undergo intensive or standard of chemotherapy again. I think there the future will be definitely chemotherapy free. In the younger patients, I'm not that optimistic. I think we still will need intensive chemotherapy as a debulking strategy, but this may followed by MRD guided specific interventions with targeted treatment, and therefore maybe you need to take advantage of both of these concepts for the younger patients. But of course, the actually research and also our understanding of the biology of the disease is evolving, and we may end up with a chemotherapy-free regimen also in the near future, in very specific subgroup of patients, maybe molecular-based subgroup of patients.
Professor Wei, what are your views on AML?
So this is a very interesting area. We know that for older patients with AML, venetoclax in combination with hypomethylating agents such as azacitidine appears to be the most proven combination for older patients unfit for intensive chemotherapy. Whether this more general regimen can be replaced by a targeted prospect remains at this stage an open question. Not presented at this year's meeting, but there was a study combining azacitidine with gilteritinib, a FLT3 inhibitor, and this study, at least in a press statement, was demonstrated to be negative in terms of improving survival for patients with a FLT3 mutation. At previous congresses, enasidenib in combination with azacitidine for IDH2 mutant disease also did not show a survival benefit over azacitidine alone. In both of these studies, there was the potential problem that patients in the control arm received these targeted drugs as a kind of crossover after completing the study therapy. And so we don't yet know whether, if this did not happen, a benefit may in fact have been observed. But at this stage, targeted therapies remain an open question. There were certainly some new drugs presented at this year's EHA, which gives us a tempting insight into the future. For instance, there was another IDH1 inhibitor presented called FT2102, and this study had a 46% response rate in patients with an IDH1 mutation with a response duration of almost 1 year. And interestingly, in patients that achieved a complete remission or a CRH, the 12-month survival was very high, over 80%, which is certainly very encouraging for this agent. So we look forward to hopefully future congresses and hopefully the evolution of novel therapies with respect to targetable options to see whether venetoclax plus azacitidine can be displaced from its universal use in older patients currently.
Do you have any takeaway messages from EHA 2021 virtual on newly diagnosed AML, Professor Santini?
During EHA 2021, there were several data regarding targeted agents used in AML. Newly diagnosed AML, in fact, have been shown to respond very well to several FLT3 inhibitors and to other inhibitors. And of course, many new data have been presented on quizartinib, gilteranib, midostaurin. I think it was a very evolving and an interesting landscape of inhibitors. And of course, venetoclax has been now used quite broadly, even in Europe. So there were data from the Spanish group indicating in a rather small group of patients that venetoclax use in real life, so not within in a clinical study, can be really manageable. Now, they presented data on 51 patients, and the patients had received only a median of 2 cycles. So, I mean, it's not what we have seen out of the clinical trial, but it's important to note that some patients could, after this therapy, undergo a transplant. Then the overall survival of the patients who responded was 10 months, and the patients who did not respond had something like 5 months of disease of survival. Now, another very interesting factor is that in this small study, there were not only newly diagnosed AML, but also patients who had relapsed. And also these patients had some response that were, of course, not really impacted by a longer overall survival. But indeed, it's a proof of concept that venetoclax and azacitidine can be used widely in real life and without major concern in terms of toxicity. There were very few toxicity reports in this study. And another very preliminary but very interesting study, also by a Spanish, this time it's a multi-center Spanish study, was regarding iadademstat, that is an LSD1 inhibitor. It's an oral drug, so I think that the future will be oral therapy, not only replacing chemo, but also replacing the IV and sub-Q therapies. And this would be a very great advantage in terms of quality of life for our patients, frail or not frail even, and preparing to transplant. Now, this inhibitor has received the orphan drug designation, although very few patients have been treated. Many more in solid tumors, and 27 patients with AML. Now, the main reported side effect of this study was myelosuppression. And the positive of the study was the patients achieved very quickly a good response after 1 cycle. And the overall response rate was nearly 83%, so very good data. And the patients responded also with CR. The iadademstat drug is in inducing a differentiation. And out of these 27 patients, there was 1 patient who had a differentiation syndrome. But otherwise, our side effects were not so important. Now, the combination then of a specific anti-LSD1 together with azacitidine seemed to be extremely active and it doesn't seem to add a lot of toxicity. So is this a target therapy? Is this a more, let's say, epigenetic and chromatin targeting chemotherapy? We don't know exactly what will be the future of all these agents, but probably many agents will be combining triplets and similar to what has been done for other hematological diseases.
Professor Wei, what criteria and or assessment tools do you use for determining patient fitness for intensive induction chemotherapy?
This is an age-old question whereby clinicians are asking themselves whether they should use conventional intensive chemotherapy for an older patient or one of the newer combinations such as venetoclax in combination with azacitidine. I think the distinction now between fitness for intensive or non-intensive therapy is perhaps less important than it was in the past. And that's because in the past, hypomethylating agents or low-dose ROC had such a poor response rate that these agents were really only reserved for patients who were extremely poor risk or had a lot of comorbidities. However, with combined response rates of venetoclax now approaching 70%, the situation has changed quite a lot. So patients that we might consider for these less intensive options might in fact not just be patients who are considered very high risk in terms of early mortality from intensive chemotherapy, but also patients that we would classify as being genetically unfit for intensive chemotherapy. That is, patients that are not likely to benefit from intensive chemotherapy because of the known poor outcomes associated with this treatment. So this might include patients with secondary AML or poor risk mutations such as P53 mutant disease, where intensive chemotherapy really hasn't been shown to be of great benefit for this population. However, at the moment, even drugs like venetoclax may also not be entirely beneficial for patients with poor risk mutations such as P53 mutant disease, and we need to look to the future for the possibility of newer agents such as immunotherapeutic drugs, which might help to improve the very poor outcomes in these patients.
Do you have anything to add regarding the assessment of patient eligibility for intensive induction chemotherapy, Professor Santini?
This is the fitness, the evaluation of fitness of patient is a very long debate and has raised a lot of discussion. As a matter of fact, when I have to evaluate whether a patient is fit or unfit, I put together several factors. So I consider patient and disease-related variable to understand prognosis, but also to understand what is the attitude of the patient. That is very important. So the patient, strictly clinical patient-related factors are age and performance status, so the presence of severe and important comorbidities. I would add for very old patients also the level of cognitive impairment, yes or no. And therefore, with these parameters, I can understand the base of the ability to support and sustain a chemotherapy. And then there are the intrinsic disease-related factors that are not really considered as patient-related, but very, very important. Now, of course, if the patient has a poor risk cytogenetics or previous MDS, these are patients that will not respond, very probably will not respond to chemotherapy. And therefore, the option of high-dose chemo, even if the patient is fit, has to be considered very carefully. And then I added that beside what I just said, I consider also the family, whether the patient has caregiver that can assist the patient, the social status. And what is very important is the needs and will of the patient. Some patients will go for aggressive therapy without any doubts, and they will consider it a good option. Some others will refuse it. And therefore, a good discussion after having evaluated the patient health condition and the performance status is really to understand what the patient wants and explain what are the pros and cons of high-dose chemo, if applicable.
Professor Platzbecker, what are your thoughts?
I think this is a very complex field and area, And I think many of us, unfortunately, do not use a standardized approach to assess fitness for intensive induction therapy. I think the major driver to assess fitness and the major also maybe biomarker is age per se. So I think patients up to the age of 60, 65 are in general considered to be fit, also with regards to organ fitness, to undergo an intensive chemotherapy. So I think, therefore, fitness testing or assessment tools to assess these kind of patient fitness are not widely used. I think then there's a gray zone of patients between 60 and 70, where we, in our clinic here, sometimes use a so-called walking test for the assessment of fitness. But of course, fitness is also part of organ function. So echocardiography, lung testing, and so on are also part of this, let's say, holistic assessment. And then with the clinical experience of an experienced hematologist, I think you can make then a respective decision on whether you treat this patient intensively or offer non-intensive first-line treatment.
Finally, Professor Santini, how do you see MRD monitoring evolving in terms of methodology and standardization? And what impact do you see it having on the management of MDS and AML in the future?
MRD is coming back. It's very important, and it's coming let's say, of age, even in MDS, not only in AML. There were a couple of abstracts dealing with MRD with different methods and coming from the same group of Femut Dono, and they are very interesting. The first abstract I really thought was quite interesting is the one concerning the evaluation of MRD after venetoclax azacitidine. That means that the patient who received this treatment were not receiving chemo, and traditionally we were not prone to measure MRD. As a matter of fact, the patient included in the VILE study were in a small, not a, such a small subgroup, a group of patients was evaluated for MRD and by flow, so by flow cytometry evaluation. MRD below 10 to the minus 3 was considered significant, and 41% of the patients receiving venetoclax plus azacitidine achieved it. Now, what is interesting is that the patient who experienced this MRD had a duration of duration of remission and overall survival significantly longer, and the estimate survival at 1 year was above 90%. So I think that this is the first time that we can say that even in not aggressive chemo, high dose chemo regimens, MRD has a prognostic importance, and achieving MRD is extremely relevant for the outcome of patient, for evaluating the outcome of patient. And this is something quite new. Now, regarding the methods, beside flow cytometry, there were data indicating that NGS, so molecular evaluation by NGS of MRD, and in specific in patient receiving high-dose chemo and midostaurin for being a FLT3 ITD was very important indeed. This is because in this sense, we with this method, we may evaluate variant allele frequency. And the variant allele frequency was, in fact, evaluated at the beginning of therapy and the end of treatment. And the reduction, the significant reduction of the variant allele frequency was at the end of treatment was really considered a favorable variable for overall survival and absence of relapse. So I think that, again, improving and applying more sophisticated methodology for evaluating RRD in a subgroup of patients may be of great help in tailoring better therapies and understanding early what is the outcome of the patients.
And Professor Wei, what are your insights on MRD monitoring?
So the basic tenet of MRD monitoring is that we can pick up submicroscopic levels of disease with the hope that we might better prognosticate and hopefully better treat patients using these more sensitive markers. MRD monitoring can be broadly categorized into either flow cytometric or molecular methods. With respect to flow cytometry, which is more broadly applicable to the AML population in particular, there are two potential uses of MRD. First of all, detection of submicroscopic levels of disease to try and perhaps estimate patients that might have a higher risk of relapse versus those that are MRD negative who might have a more prolonged remission duration. The use of MRD being positive might lend itself to the introduction of future therapies aimed at trying to eradicate persistent MRD after a prior therapy. Alternatively, the elimination of MRD in patients, particularly if that can be demonstrated to be prolonged, might actually lead to the possibility of de-escalating or ceasing treatment in some patients. At this stage, both of those possibilities remain speculative and hypothetical until properly controlled randomized studies can be performed. MRD also gives us the potential in the future, for instance, molecular MRD to in fact be used as a potential registrational endpoint. And so there was recently announced that there was an FDA study that was approved using NPM1 MRD as in fact a registrational endpoint for a new drug targeting SYK to be used in combination with induction chemotherapy to try and eradicate NPM1 MRD. So we hope that MRD in the future will be used. And at this year's Congress, there was some information showing the role of flow MRD in patients that received venetoclax plus azacitidine, showing that the proportion of patients achieving flow MRD negativity was about 23%. But more interestingly, patients that did achieve MRD negativity after venaza had a 12-month response duration of over 80% compared to patients that were MRD positive, where only 46% of patients remained in remission. Furthermore, it was demonstrated in this paper presented by Keith Pratz that after venaza, it actually takes time to achieve optimal MRD response. So after four cycles of therapy, only 50% of patients who ultimately wanted were able to achieve MRD negativity actually achieved this after four cycles, whereas after seven cycles, almost 80% of patients achieved MRD negativity. So these, I guess, landmarks are important for future studies trying to guide what additional therapies in combination with venaza might be seeking to achieve in terms of MRD optimization.
Professor Platzbecker, to close, please share any additional thoughts you have on the utility of MRD monitoring and its potential to impact on MDS and AML management.
I think MRD is the future in AML surveillance and also in MDS, because now we have a large amount of also high-risk MDS patients achieving a complete remission. As you know, MRD is actually based on the achievement of complete remission. And as a matter of fact, I think MRD does not only allow for the prediction of hematological relapse, it may also allow to detect evolving molecular events. It may also allow for the intervention of subclones, which may be druggable, like IDH, for instance, or maybe FLAT3 or others. So I think, therefore, I do believe that MRD will become a very clinically relevant tool, and it already is, but an even more valuable tool in the future for our AML and MDS patients.
Thank you very much, everyone, and thanks for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on hematological malignancies at touchoncology.com.